after nine, we're going to get started. We have a quorum, if they're all seated. Okay. I'd like to call the Finance and Administration Committee meeting to order. And the agenda is before us. Are there any questions on the agenda?
Yes.
Mr. Benjamin.
There are, in fact, two additional items that I think we ought to consider. Whether or not we talk about them today ought to be a consideration of this group. One is the issue of the Smart Trip cost and the suggestion that has been made by staff relative to how the system might be gamed and how we might want to change that, for which we have gotten a memo. And the other one is the allocation of the reimbursement for snow costs as to where that will go. The latter we could probably postpone until next month without much loss.
Let's ask the committee regarding the addition of the Smart Trip to the agenda for today. Hearing no motion. Cannot hear me?
No.
That's unusual. The question is the addition of the agenda items. One, the Smart Trip for today. Any objections? Hearing no objections, I will accept it. And the other is the allocation of the revenue from the reimbursement for snow. And that should be.
Are you going to put that on the agenda or postpone it till next month?
I think it should be a quick decision.
Okay.
Okay, right. So we'll put it on the agenda.
All right. Thank you
no
very
objections
much.
To those additions.
And may I also request a moment of personal privilege after you have the agenda and the minutes taken care of?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin the agenda with the general manager and Mr. Kubitschek giving us an update on the Labor Day repair work that was done.
Okay. We had a very successful effort on Labor Day weekend with regard to both capital improvements and maintenance on the Red Line, and I'd like Dave Kubitschek to just give a spend a brief few minutes describing what went on.
Okay. Good morning. If you could go to the next slide, please. We've got about nine different slides here that we'll go through very quickly this morning to kind of give you all an overview of what was addressed over the Labor Day weekend. We did have involved over 750 maintenance employees throughout. That was not only tracking structures, but it included individuals like IT, plant maintenance, elevator, escalators, just a host of individuals throughout. The other thing that we kind of did that was a little bit different is that since this effort was so large, the top screen or top picture to the right here, this was actually where we actually had a control center out on the main line to actually track and monitor all of the equipment and work activities that was taking place. Here in the middle just kind of gives you an idea of safety briefings and contacts that were happening before every shift as we were mobilizing people in and out of the work locations. And over here we've kind of got some representation of safety materials, guidelines, things that we were posting, you know, to our employees that was out there. And we're also very proud to say that we did not have, with all those people there, we did not have any serious injuries to any employee of any discipline out there. So that was probably the most pleasing aspect of the amount of work that was out there. Next slide, please. Just to kind of give you an idea of the type of work that we're actually doing on these outages, what we have here, the top right screen, that's actually north of Silver Spring where the guarded number 8s are at. This is the type of work where they go in, they demo everything out and replace it in kind 100%. This left picture right in here is a view of what we're accelerating our work, where we're actually either hauling, we're building these panels from scratch, shipping these things in, or we're building them on site, and we're actually doing stuff in large, you know, prefab work efforts. The other picture here is just showing tie replacement with portal work and all the equipment stuff that's associated with that. Another area that was also very positive is that we also worked on four of the bridges up there as well that hadn't been touched in quite some time. Next slide, please. Some other accomplishments. We've got a lot of, you know, other departments. This was the first time that we had Ellison Plant also really get involved along with IT because we want to maximize our window out there. So I was very pleased with the amount of cable. You know, we've installed basically over 3 miles of cable, a lot of lighting. If you see, you know, relamped 24,000, you know, feet of tunnel lighting, that's close to 5 miles You know, we just simply can't do that in our normal work windows. And the work effort that we have, like I said, we had people working fiber optics. We had people on the stations, you know, out into the right-of-way, and anything that we could work on to make the system, you know, safer or more robust, we definitely took advantage of that. Next slide, please. Okay, on this one right here, more views of just, you know, regular track work up here at the top right. This is where they're actually doing tie inserter work. And just to kind of give you an idea is that we literally have to cut the fence or violate our fence line to basically come in and be able to insert our ties and everything else to do restoration. You've got all this other infrastructure on the other side that precludes you from taking down power and third rail and everything else. So we wanted to just to kind of give you all an idea of how tight of a dynamic envelope that we're actually working in there. And with our plan effort as well, like I said, we were able to get in work on air conditioners and fans. Even the other thing was like spot replacement of tile. That was another thing that we had. We had masons that came in, and you know, we weren't able to maybe replace and do a schedule for a total replacement, but some of the areas that we were having problems with, we addressed those as well. And like I said, escalators and elevators were also a form of a focus as well. And then the other thing was just an emphasis on good housekeeping out there to help us with our redundancy of fires and, you know, potentials of other incidents that might lead to. Go ahead, next slide. This was the first time that we had, again, Ellis up there. We got very positive feedback from the staff and everything else, again, since we had everything out. We actually did these major jurisdictional inspections, used a lot of staff, and as we continue to move forward with these other outages and stuff, on top of our normal maintenance and stuff that we're establishing here, we'll continue to do this emphasis, and we're probably going to start establishing some other specific campaigns so that way we can blitz these systems and start helping increase their reliability and the robust nature that we need them to operate in. Next slide. The bus operations, I thought that they just did an awesome job going out there. The communications, you know, the support, the people that were out there, just did a great job. We were pretty close to incident-free. We had a few incidents where some customers got a little agitated with us, but all in all, there weren't any major incidents in that respective area. And then the other area that we also had was, you know, again, naturally was transit police, our safety department, emergency management, our customer communication support, you know, that was just very, very key to be able to touch as many people out there as we possibly could. Next slide. And again, talking about, you know, the communications, this is, as we do this one and as we continue to move forward, this is kind of gives you a template of all the efforts that we are undertaking to make sure that we get out as much information as clear and as concise. We will continue to do this on every work effort that we have. It's kind of building our template and our model as we've been working out throughout the years. We do find out that the diagrams and the information and stuff that we can provide to folks seems to be received, you know, very well, you know, very positive. So we'll continue to do the, I guess you could say, the manual communications, the verbal communications, but also adding the graphic information and stuff is another focus on our part going forward. Okay, this one right in here, I just wanted to take an opportunity to provide y'all some information on what's coming up. Now, this does not cover all of the track work, weekend work, everything else. These are, for me, are significant events that we already kind of communicate on a monthly basis, but we wanted to definitely give y'all an idea of what we're actually looking at in the future, and we are planning ahead. This is very, very critical for our state of good repair. Starting with the first one, September the 27th, which will be a Monday, we will go back to doing some daytime work. We haven't done that in about 2 years. This will be the only location that we will do this at this time because it's kind of like a pilot program. I've got some speed restrictions out there on the railroad. We've got some ties that are in really bad shape, and that's what's holding up our speed and our efficiency out there. So we're going to focus on that area. It'll just be a small crew, small location. We'll give it some time and we'll see what'll happen. We might be bouncing around to other locations in the coming months and stuff, but this is an area that we will focus on, you know, right there. Now, to clarify that, if we had an emergency condition somewhere else on the railroad, naturally we would follow the same protocol and get a crew out there to work it, but this is stepping back into scheduled work, so that way we can get speed restrictions and stuff, you know, lifted. The Columbus Day, McPherson shutdown, this will have a big impact because basically we are going to have to shut down the Orange Line. There's a lot of communications going in between staff, bus, rail, reaching out to all the other respective departments. But we've got these four guarded number eights. There's really no other way for us to really go about, you know, doing this work. We could drag this stuff on for months if we don't try to address everything at the same time. We will get a little bit better definition on our actual closures of, you know, the stations and their overall impact. A lot of these bullets and stuff are very high level because there's still a lot of planning efforts and stuff that need to be filtered through with them. We're also very sensitive to the fact of that a lot of, you know, fall events throughout the region, games and everything else that would be taking place. But again, for us to maintain schedules and for us to make sure that we are staying proactive, we've got to continue this pace. November the 5th and the 7th. This is very important at the Stadium Armory. It will impact the blue and orange line at that area. We've got over 30 locations of train control for that interlocking. It's probably one of the most complicated interlockings or one of the top ones that we have on the system. And part of this is also with the NTSB recommendations as we replace these GRS modules. Instead of us dragging this thing out forever, we're going to basically do the whole interlocking. I do see that we'll probably have part of the interlocking down for about 30 hours where it will impact our ability to operate trains out to Largo. But after about 30 hours, if the schedule and stuff holds, we're looking probably like Sunday morning, we should be able to restore train service at least out to Largo. But we will be down at going out to New Carrollton. The Chevrolet Bridge, as y'all are aware, there was some adjacent issues with the impaction of soil and stuff, and you know it shifted the bridge. So what we're doing is we're actually doing utility work. We're building abutments and stuff to ensure that we are not going to be impacted in the future years, and that will be the first phase of that. Also, if you see, Pepco has some major utility work out there with feeders, and also which also impacts Amtrak's overhead. So literally, there's going to be high voltage work that's going to be taking place that's actually going to be spanning across the lines as well as all these other work activities. Whenever we have this outages, we will also add a component naturally of anything for IT, for plant maintenance, for elevator escalators, so we'll stack that. But again, we'll build this up at each event. The November 19th through the 21st, Chevrolet Bridge work, that's literally the time frame where we will be jacking up the bridge and physically moving it to get it back into realignment so that way we can go back to operating normal speed. So everything else to that point in time will be prep work. We probably won't have the outage quite as large as that area at this point in time. It'll probably shrink a little bit, you know, to pull in some service, but we did leave it as a placeholder to depend upon train module work, track work, everything else as we're getting ready for the winter months and stuff for that. The last item, again, 2011, just to give you a heads up, Martin Luther King, you know, again, guarded number eight. It'll probably be the same orchestration that you would see that would take place at McPherson Square since it's on this same alignment, same impact and such. But unfortunately, this is just the best way for us to do it at this point in time. And again, there'll be a massive communication effort on these the latter four that'll be in greater detail, a lot of outreach and stuff. But I just wanted to let y'all know these are some major events coming forward, as well as our day-to-day activities that we're having. So I'm open for questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kubitschek. I think the work is highlighted by the fact of the enormous amount of work that was done with safety, I think at its best, as well as accomplishing the good repair that we needed. So it's not visible to the public in a lot of places. Some we did see some the lighting and all those things that are done, but I think it's really important that you highlight how much is done and the schedule and template. It seems to be working quite fine. Let me start on this side with Mr. Downey.
A couple of quick questions. In this weekend, we have all the people out there. What length of time were they working during the day? How long was the shift?
We had it capped off at a 12-hour shift.
Okay, so they get time to
absolutely, not absolutely.
Fatigue. Great. Second question. For these upcoming events, are you also looking to schedule other associated work while the trackage is out?
Absolutely. If we can fit anything in there, we're definitely going to take advantage of it. And so I did kind of focus the plant maintenance work and the Ellis work. We're definitely going to start capitalizing on that to draw them into the fold of what's taking place, as well as IT for any communications work.
And just to add to that, as we go through our planning meetings, Dave does a lot, and then at my level, we try to just layer everything in here to get as much out of the opening as possible and improve the situation.
And in one of the run-up stories to this, I did see a number, but I don't remember what it was, as to how many normal outages it would have taken to accomplish what was done in 3 days. It was well over 100.
It's easily over 150. I mean, for example, we did some fire line work that was over there. That was probably saved us at least 200 outages alone. So it's pretty complex, because we can say we achieved X for the IT, for the fiber, for, you know, for communications. We achieved X for the fire lines, you know, for the stations and stuff. So when you put that cumulative number together, you know, you're talking about hundreds of days of outages that was accelerated and addressed in just a matter of, you know, 84 hours or so. And then the other positive of that is that it accelerates us to permit us to go work in other areas of the system to make sure that we try to stay in front of this stuff to become more proactive.
Great accomplishment.
Mr. Benjamin, or it's Mr. McKay and then Mr. Benjamin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to compliment you as well on the Labor Day work, because, you know, I got zero complaints about it, which is pretty amazing given the amount of work that was done and the inconveniences, although expected inconveniences of our customers. My question is, and I'm looking at the sheet that we have, which is quite a bit different than the one up here. This one's much more detailed and much better, but I noticed on September 27th, and you might have covered this, I might have missed it, but I'm trying to understand, you know, when you say single tracking there, number one, what kind of a projected time delay would that be for a typical passenger? And then number two, we picked a Monday from 10 to 2, and I'm kind of wondering what the rationale behind that is, because it strikes me as a Monday after Labor Day, you know, there may be a better time to do it. Is there a reason why it has to be done in that window?
Okay, I'll address the time frame first, the 10 a.m. to 2. We ramp down our peak service between 9 and 9:30. So what we look at doing is to get through the a.m. peak service period first, let the equipment stuff get back to the barn, let it get clear to reduce the amount of train activity that's out there. Then we roll out this equipment to do the work. We work up until about 2 o'clock, because starting about 2:30 and 3, that's whenever we start deploying revenue service to support peak periods. I'll talk about that as well. Now, for the single tracking, we picked this specific location because we've got an interlocking at East Falls Church and an interlocking at West Falls Church. We run about a 12 to 15 minute headway. So in a single tracking effort, with the amount of distance that we have between the interlocking, we should be able to maintain that schedule as is, as published. And that's part of the reason why we're also staying out of the core. I can't really necessarily do this type of work in the core, because our duty cycle is too aggressive and we would definitely impact the customers. But staying outside of the core in these respective locations, that's our target, is to do this work with minimal to no impact on the posted schedules to the customers out there.
Okay, let me just follow up quickly. If your completion date, well, I assume this is only one day if I'm reading this right. It's only on September
27th. No, we'll be out there probably for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because we don't have an end date for people to know. And I think as we finalize the schedule, I mean, September 27th is right around the corner. We should probably give people an idea of how long this is going to be taking place. And this is not work then that can be done on weekends or on evenings.
It is work that could be done on the weekends and it could, or at night. But what I'm trying to do here with staff is add additional work, because we do have speed restrictions out there. The ties are in bad shape, and the more work that we get done, the sooner that we can restore the system back to operational speeds. But we are very sensitive, and that's why we're piloting it at this single location, because if we're not successful and we cause a lot of, you know, massive delays and we really impact our customers and stuff, I will be the first one to pull the plug on this and regroup and try something else different. you know, several years ago, they did this on a regular basis, and there was a lot of, you know, interruptions to customers throughout the region. I committed on my part to do a better job of changing practices and schedules and refocus the group. But at the same point in time, the effort behind this is all about state of good repair and also the efficiency and speed of the system out there. So, like I said, I will be my own worst, well, I'm sure other people will be very quick critics of me. I will be my own worst critic as well, because if it's not efficient, we will pull out of it. But again, the interlockings at West Falls Church and East Falls Church with the Hidway, looking to basically, we can run the schedule.
That was a key thing for me, that we're not actually impacting the customer with any significance here at all, hopefully.
Thank you. And my maintenance staff is very, very much aware that if we are not efficient, that we go back to working nights.
First of all, I'd like to compliment the general manager and Mr. Kubitschek and Mr. Requa for really an excellent job. I heard that one of the things that really concerned me with all of these people working simultaneously was a potential for conflict between the groups, and in particular concerns about safety. I heard that not only was that proactively dealt with and people were set up and aware of the issues, but that they were monitoring themselves and one another, and that in several instances when somebody was doing something that was a little bit beyond where they were supposed to be, other people went to them and suggested self-corrections and in some cases even stronger actions. So I was impressed with the fact that safety was foremost in doing this, which is really critical when you have that many people doing that many things in a construction project. So. Congratulations, that was well done. Also, Mr. Linton and I would have been more sensitive than most of the other board members since the closed stations were in Montgomery County. Not only did I not hear after an initial set of comments from business owners in the Silver Spring area who commented before anything actually happened, not only did I not hear anything during the entire weekend that was negative, but I actually got a couple people who said that the bus service was so good they wished we would run it all the time.
So, Mr. Requa, who was back there hiding at one point.
Congratulations on running good bus service. What that shows, actually, is the difference between being able to do something like this when it's planned and when you're putting in service that you know you're going to have to put in, having the people and the routes and everything else figured out and having the MIPS available to send people to the right places, and when you have to respond to an emergency where it's far more difficult because the equipment isn't there, the people aren't there, and it's really hard to get them there. So thank you very much. It was a really, really well done job, and I particularly appreciate the attention to safety.
Let me just, first of all, I too want to commend Mr. Kubitschek and our general manager and Mr. Requa for a job well done. This is kind of a good news, bad news story. And we should do the most that we can to make sure that all the good news is out. I mean, the bad news is the fact that we have to disrupt service. And anytime you disrupt service, that is, in fact, bad news for customers. But the good news is that it's being done for all our customers' benefit. I haven't looked at the direct communications messaging or plan, but I think it's very important that we tell the good news. And also to the stakeholders and members of Congress and others who tend to jump on us when something is going wrong, I think it's really good for them to get some detailed briefings on exactly what we're doing, how we're doing it, and the multitude of rehabs and changes that we're making to the system. So they know that, one, the money's being used very well, activity's been done, and I think particularly picking up on Mr. Benjamin's point, what we have done differently in the area of safety. I think if, you know, we can make some comparisons to what we may have done in the past in a similar type of engagement and what we've done differently now, I think it's important to kind of highlight that in terms of the moves that we're making in the right direction. We had press conferences. Were they before or after, or when were the press conferences held?
I know that there was communications by the media before. Definitely before, and then there were press releases, you know, during the course of that, and actually whenever we were having our daily conference calls, media relations was an active participant, so that way they were able to get any information that they needed at that time, and they were able to communicate, you know, out to their respective outlets.
And I think I saw some messaging after it was done, too, that kind of said to the customers it was completed and job was completed. And I think it's important for us to thank our customers as well for both their inconvenience but also acknowledging to them that this is work that's being done on their behalf, if that's in part of the communication. But I think it's been a great approach. We should write it up as a case study, too. I think it's something that we should let others see how we're moving in this.
Mr. Marshall, thank you.
Excuse me?
No, I was going to Mr. Marshall.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman, and congratulations on the great work. And it's great that this is helping us meet many of the recommendations that were brought forward by the NTSB in particular. I did have a question about the October 8th closing, which I believe is on Columbus Day weekend. And you're closing some of the busiest stations on the red line and I believe the orange line. I had a question about Columbus Day, and I know a lot of people are still working on Columbus Day, and I'm just wondering if you've made special provisions to accommodate those customers because, you know, federal government, of course, is closed, but I do believe that a lot of private sector businesses will be open. And I just want to get a sense of the ridership during that time versus, say, Labor Day, where everything is closed.
We are very sensitive to that. There was some events that have been canceled in the district, which we were having to work through that were going to be obstacles for the bus service. And then we're also going to be looking at some of our rail service options as well to, you know, maximize to get people, you know, for example, from Virginia into the district and vice versa. So we are very sensitive to that. And as we get more information, and that's why we're vetting this is now, is to communicate in advance as much as possible to our customers on the options. You know, not only just the work itself that's taking place, but one of the biggest focuses is to provide them options on how they can move throughout the region during these times.
Go right ahead. Mr. Zimmerman, I'd like that.
Oh, no.
No, you didn't? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. The presentation was very important to do, and I appreciate the tolerance of the committee to have the time to do it. And, we'd like to go to the agenda, and I have a motion. I'm sorry, Mr. Benjamin, you had one more item.
Yes.
Early on.
I would just like to note that I currently sit in the seat that used to be occupied, not this physical seat, but the position on the board, that used to be occupied by Cletus Barnett. Cletus Barnett died just recently in Florida, was a board member for 30 years and an enormous contributor to this authority. I worked very closely with Cletus because he was forever the chair of this committee, the Finance Committee, and cared deeply about the finance of this authority, the operations of this authority, the way we served our public. Cletus was one of those people who not only delivered for Montgomery County in the state of Maryland, but really cared about a regional system and really cared about making a difference in assuring that Metro was built and served the public effectively. He was one of those people who believed firmly that our number one job was to provide service, safe, clean, reliable service. He said that repeatedly, and he was one of those people who looked at our books all the time, and I know that because I was the one that was showing them to him, looked at our books repeatedly to make absolutely certain that every penny was being spent as effectively as possible. He was a wonderful public servant. He is a person that we missed from the day he left, and it is sad to hear now that he did die. I hope that his family does well and remembers what a wonderful contribution he has made to this authority and to this region. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sure we all do in your comments. Okay, now we'll go to the agenda item. The approval of the minutes, is there a motion?
So moved.
Second. All those in favor, questions? None? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. First item is the, there are several items on this agenda, and so we want to go through them as quickly as possible. And the first item is on the bus systems infrastructure. I think we need some detail on the progress of that. And Mr. Kubitschek, are you beginning that item?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I move this item without a presentation?
If there are no objections to doing so,
so
are there any questions?
Second.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Kubitschek, that's fine. All those in favor of moving forward with the rehabilitation on the infrastructure, and just so that the public understands that this is the bus facilities infrastructure rehab that's going on throughout the system. Mm-hmm. And this is the next stage of it, and this is going out for an informational procurement piece that we'll come back to us again. Mm-hmm. Okay, those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that item's done. The next three items are actually items that have also been before, and they are moving through the process. The West Falls Church Station canopy is the canopies are in place, and this is to provide the lighting, and it has seen the eyes of the jurisdictional staff, and I think it's ready to move forward. Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Next is the approval for the Southern Avenue Bus Garage project. And again, the project has been before us for briefing as well as prior action. I think are there questions regarding the item for presentation? If not,
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Where are the two sites, and what is the position of Prince George's County on the two sites?
I believe there has been staff. I think there's been consultation with the jurisdiction on this one. And
good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Thomas. I can address Mr. Benjamin's comments. The two sites are referred to Site A. It's called the Andrews Federal Center. It's near the intersection of Suitland Parkway and the Capitol Beltway.
Okay.
The second one, so it's sort of southwest of that intersection. The second site is northeast of the intersection of Pennsylvania Avenue and the Capitol Beltway, Westphalia Road.
Okay. All right. And have we talked with Prince George's County, and are they feeling comfortable with it?
So far, yes. But the process here is to go through a detailed evaluation of both sites from an environmental standpoint, but also engaging Prince George's County officials and other stakeholders like residents and so forth.
And will the environmental include deadheading issues and extra costs associated with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. No more questions.
Mr. Linton.
Are these design builds?
Both sites are just conceptualized right now. So the proposal here is that each of the proposers will develop preliminary engineering documents for their respective sites. And that this process will result in a decision that we make on which of the two sites is the better site. And the schedule we have has us coming back to the board next September to make a decision on which of the sites is better. After we make that selection, we would then go into negotiations on a specific design-build agreement.
But that design, that agreement would be with the chosen owner of the site, and they then would do a design build if they're selected?
Yes, sir. The proposal's from a design build team with a landowner partner. So it's a group that's come together. So the negotiations would be for the sale of the property and then the design build aspect.
So the selection is going to be made primarily on the basis of the environmental and the location and not on design?
No, there will be a design component to it as well as a dollar component to it.
Conceptually, a design up to a certain?
Correct.
20%, 30%?
About 20%, yeah.
20%.
So we'll be able to make a fully informed decision, not just on the design or the dollars, but also any of the environmental impacts associated with each of the respective sites and any mitigation that goes with any of the environmental impacts.
And they will bring their own team for the design and build for the entire project.
Absolutely, that's the plan.
Madam Chair, also, once
go right ahead.
once you evaluate the design and the dollar amount and the environmental issues, then it's also there's also the third possibility, if they're not viable, that you can remain at its current location and just rebuild there.
Correct. We'll go through an alternatives analysis that includes two proposed sites plus the rebuild in place at the existing southern location. So, and plus the no-build alternative. So those will be the four, you know, if you will, alternatives that we look at and evaluate.
Madam Chair, if you're ready
for a motion,
I move approval.
Second.
Okay. And the motion is for it
to go forward with
the Avenue Garage. All those in favor?
Aye.
And opposed? The next item is an amendment to the Potomac Yard project, which is a reimbursable project, and this is making adjustments to the project cost as well. And just two sentences on the project and a motion.
Okay, I'm ready to move approval on this one with one clarification.
Okay.
Let's do
two sentences. We want the public to also know what we're doing. So your questions are going to be pertinent as well. Yes.
This is the next step in advancing a new station on the blue-yellow line, an infill station between Braddock Road and National Airport stations. We've done a feasibility study and looked at alternative locations. The next step is to advance the project into the environmental evaluation stage, likely to be an environmental impact statement.
Okay.
that's all. This is right, is to advance it to the environmental stage. It doesn't include anything else.
That's it. Just
and so help me understand why the cost doubled. What is the driver of that?
The discussions we've had with both the Federal Transit Administration and National Park Service, who is a key federal interest in this project, have resulted in the conclusion that we believe we're doing an environmental impact statement as opposed to an environmental assessment. And the estimated cost of doing the environmental impact statement is what's driving the dollars here.
Okay. And one other question. At what point in time, you have a very brief, and I guess at this stage of the project appropriate, cost and benefit analysis in the presentation. At what point in time in this process is there going to be a much more, thorough analysis of, I mean, obviously, one of the implications in service is increased travel time on the blue and yellow lines, and it's, you know, we don't really know what that means. At what point in time is that really going to be weighed with the benefits of this new station? When will we get a thorough analysis of that?
We're probably about a year to 15 months away from having a much thorough analysis of all of the various impacts of what the project would entail and what would be involved in, you know, advancing the project.
Okay, so just to be clear, we are advancing the environmental analysis at this point. We are not approving the station. We're beginning a process to evaluate the pros and cons of the station at a later date and have that discussion. But we're not today approving the station. We're only approving the next advancement in the process of going to an environmental analysis.
Yes, sir. And eventually we'd have to have a public hearing, and we would have to come back to the board with a full analysis of the station and its impacts for board approval to hold that public hearing.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Did I hear something?
I just wanted to get a clarification on the answer to Mr. McKay's last question. Mr. McKay was asking about when this would be, you know, these kind of things would be coming forward. Do you have a time frame? Is the answer to the question that the question Mr. McKay asked is part of what is being will be analyzed in this process that would be approved today?
Yes, we have to do all those analyses.
Right. So the EIS, in fact, would produce the kind of data that addresses the question Mr. McKay
Yes, sir.
Asking. Thank you.
I'd like to move this item with one clarification. The resolution is very clear that the $1.5 million added will come from the City of Alexandria. The Mead is not quite as clear. Can we please clarify on Mead, because both of them become part of the record, that the funding will come from the City of Alexandria? With that clarification, I move this item.
Second.
Okay. Any other questions?
My question was asked and answered. My question was asked and answered.
Mark.
One thing I is not clear to me, this work, as Mr. Benjamin just made clear, is it's a reimbursable project, so the jurisdiction's paying for it. But it's being done by Metro engineering staff, basically?
The bulk of the work will be done by our planning consultants, AECOM.
Through Metro?
Through us, correct.
Okay, this is the one thing that isn't entirely clear to me, because I thought Metro was moving away from doing that, and where projects like this, which are all reimbursable now, pretty much the jurisdiction has to get the funding, that the jurisdiction was responsible for that. Metro wasn't doing that anymore. Is this now a change back to the old way of doing things?
I think that's a policy question that maybe Dave or Mr. Charles can.
Well, Mr. Thomas is clear.
We have to be involved because this thing directly, you know, impacts our alignment.
Of course you have to be involved.
Phases.
The question is whether you're responsible for doing the contracting or the jurisdiction is responsible for doing the contracting. And about 2-3 years ago, Metro moved away from that and said, you want the project, that's fine, we're in it, and you'll pay us for parts we do, but you have to contract with, you know, the major firms that do this and all this, and, you know, it's more the jurisdiction's responsibility. So I'm not advocating for either that system or what we did before. I'm just asking, have we now shifted so now Metro, in fact, is going to take on those duties again?
In this case, Jack Requa has the background on this, how we're to this point, so I'd like him to talk about that.
Let me try to answer that. The previous general manager had an interest in going away from it, as you say. But the one caveat was that if it was an integral part of the system, that felt that it should be under our lead to do that. So from the purpose of discussions with the city of Alexandria, a project of this magnitude and this involvement and criticalness to the system, the general manager was agreeable to take the lead on this so that we had our hands on top of it.
I can understand that. Would you say that any major modification to a station in the system would be a major integral part of the system?
I think that would be consistent with his thoughts at the time, yes.
Okay. Oh. And so if you were doing it now, this is essentially the approach you would take.
I'll leave that to the people to the right.
Not having a lot of history here, but based on my past history, I would agree with that approach, that where it's really integral to the station and the operation in close proximity, that we should be, you know, taking the lead.
Because my jurisdiction, as you may know right now, is managing a $60 million project for the Roslyn Station, which I think we'd agree is integral to the system. You know, I can tell you all the reasons why you might not want to do it that way, and my, you know, county staff people can tell you all the reasons that they'd be happy to have you doing what you're done in the past and what you're now doing for Alexandria. But I just wanted to know if, you know, so we're the only ones that are going to ever have to have had that experience. Thank you very much. Just wanted to know.
I guess the clarity of that is that we'd like to determine whether it's consistency or another criteria that determines which way we go. So, all right. All those in favor of moving us forward?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. The next item is an approval to amend the FY11 capital budget, and this is actually moving funding from the capital garage of an amount that was not spent, and I'm sorry, the southeastern garage, and so that it can be moved for a parking facilities, rehabs and rehabilitation. And I think we have, who do we have? Mr. Kubitschek?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Again, I'd be willing to move this one. I'd like one clarification before we do, though. Mm-hmm. And that is the funding impact statement on this shows $5 million coming from Southeastern Bus Garage, mm-hmm. which I have, or $6 million, which I have no problem with, but it shows the total budget for the Southeastern Bus Garage as being the same $6 million, which would then put it at zero, as this says, and that seems highly unlikely. So the question is, what in fact are the correct numbers?
Is it going to zero or not, Mr.?
Yeah, if you go to the second page of the board action information mm-hmm. summary, the funding impact says the budget for the Southeast Eastern Bus Garage is $5.732 million.
Mr. Benjamin,
all going.
I can address that, Matt Brown. That's the annual budget for fiscal year 11. The total six-year budget for that project is $51 million.
Okay, so you're saying there's no more money that we're going to spend in 11?
In the current fiscal year, the funds are not needed.
On the Southeastern Bus Garage?
If I may, Matt.
Please.
The there's a project budget that's outside of the CIP. This is the CIP money only. So the project can advance in FY11 without this particular sum of money, the $5.7 million. The out years in the CIP are still being reserved for the project, but not needed for this fiscal year.
So what are the expenditures that are not budgeted?
No, it's not that they're not budgeted. It's okay. The sales proceeds that we have from the sale of Southeast plus the ARRA money that we have in the project budget are sufficient to cover the expenses and obligations that we have for this fiscal year.
And where is that budgeted?
That's in the DC Village project budget.
Okay, I guess this is raising a much bigger concern for me, and that's a basic financial concern. There should be no projects for which there is not an approval of an overall budget by the board for this year. And what you're telling me is we appear to have off-budget projects that are funded from other sources?
They were previously approved budgets that were rolled over from one fiscal year to the next.
I hear that, but every year we should have a budget that says this is what this authority is going to spend on everything,
yes, sir.
Not just the things that are in any one category. Did we do that?
Yes, sir. That was included in the board resolution when the board adopted the budget.
Okay, so when we approved the budget, the annual budget, we approved this item, but it was not in the CIP?
There were estimates of the rollover expenditures included in the board package from June 24th for each of the reimbursable projects and for the ARRA projects. I think what we may need to do is do a better job in the fiscal impact statement and showing those amounts that have been
previously.
That
would be very helpful, so we know what it is that we're dealing with.
It's
a whole project, not just there. Here's a little piece in one item.
We can certainly do that.
I think Mr. Downey looks like he has the same concern I do.
Yeah. Well, I have the opposite, so I'd
okay.
Let me just follow up on what you were saying, though, because I think the questions keep coming up, and I think they're the right questions to ask because it's not easily discernible. But I think if we would lift each piece out of the capital budget and really outline, and that may be the piece that we want as part of the item next time, and that way we can actually determine whether or not what we've approved and what we see here.
Well, I guess the other part of that is it would be helpful if we knew very clearly when we were approving the fiscal 11 budget what the various pieces of that budget were. I certainly looked at it, I thought, pretty carefully and didn't realize that, for instance, this project was funded out of three different areas and that we were approving all three areas separately, but that it was all there. So it would be nice somehow to integrate our capital program somewhere.
Well, so what we'll do is on this meet, we will actually modify it to reflect the total budget for the project, and we'll identify when that particular project was approved. In this case, it was approved in the prior year. And then what happens is if the spending is not done in that prior year, we'll indicate what the spending plan would be for this FY 2011 budget. So what happens is you have rollover projects that occur. Now, what you're asking is a great question, but the meet should have identified that and clarified.
I guess my question, and I agree with that, and I think that's what Matt was offering, and I appreciate that. I guess it's the other part is I think the board needs to understand when it's approving an annual budget what the entire capital budget is, and if there are six elements to it, what are the six elements and what's the grand total?
Right. So what happens in June when the board approved the capital budget for FY 2011, it was very specific and detailed. What the board now has to see is the what we didn't spend at the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, because that piece will be rolled over and will actually increase our capital budget, and we will be showing that to you in October when we do our reconciliation. So that's the piece that you will want to see as well.
Okay. I'd like to have a pretty good idea as to what it is, and what you're talking about here is, yes, I understand there's a rollover in this one because we've approved a sum of money that stays there.
Right.
But we ought to be approving the expenditures on each project and the grand total, and what you're saying is I don't think I know what the grand total is.
Mm-hmm. For this particular project?
No, or for the total capital program, for everything that's there. It may be that I do, but in my head it's not sticking.
Right. Just for clarification, what was approved in June was a $718 $1 million capital program. And what now, at the end of June 30th, we had monies that were not spent on capital projects. The spending plan was lower than anticipated. So what we need to bring back to the board is what that dollar amount is, so that then you will have that number for FY11.
Okay, so we did not actually approve it in June.
The amounts for the ARA projects, the amounts for the reimbursable projects, the budgets had been approved in previous fiscal years by the board. That information was included in the attachments for the budget adoption resolution.
Those were the totals. I'm talking about the FY11 expenditure portion.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You don't have that information because on June 30th, by the time we actually finish the end of the fiscal year, we actually look at July's numbers, and then we realize what was not spent in FY 2010.
So you're saying we don't approve the actual capital budget for FY11 until well into FY11?
No, I say that you are approving the capital budget for FY 2011, and then when we finally end our fiscal year, we can come back to the board and tell you what those expenditures are that are going to roll over. That's how it's planned.
We did include a forecast of expenditures for ARA.
Yeah, that's correct. We did give you a forecast, but not knowing what those expenditures were until we finally closed out our year was impossible to provide. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I have the same concern.
Yeah.
I view the capital plan as a multi-year activity of which the budget is a slice, but I certainly believe that every project should be in the plan and every funding source should be in the plan. And I think what we need is a way to manage that so there's visibility. If there's, subjects that come up a number of times about old sources of funding and old projects,
right.
To the extent we can milk money out of those, I'd like to put them to new work. But we have to be able to see it all.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions on this? Hearing none.
I think I was in the middle of moving this week.
I think you were. So you can finish that.
Until I learned that I didn't know what the budget was.
Yeah.
So I'm moving this action.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Okay. Hearing no questions, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. The next item is actually the policy issue on reprogramming for the Metro Capital Budget. And I think we should take some time to go through this presentation because it's this the item that was to come to us after we had adopted our capital budget.
And this is timely because it's talking about the reprogramming of our capital budget and reviewing those current policies. Matt Brown's going to take you through that recommendation.
So the purpose of this presentation and the request for board action is to update Metro's capital budget reprogramming policies. What we're talking about is the movement of funds that can occur after the adoption of the annual budget. As is contemplated in the capital funding agreement, on an annual basis, we will be fully updating the six-year CIP. And as you know, the first draft of that will be provided to the committee and to the jurisdictions on October 14th. The existing capital budget reprogramming policy dates from 2000, prior to the adoption of Metro Matters. During this time, project expenditures have grown from about $158 million in FY 2000 to an adopted budget of well over $700 million in the current year, plus ARA, plus rollover, plus those things that we just talked about with the previous items. Metro during this time has also transitioned to an expenditure-based budget, where we were previously obligation-based. That means that we budget the amounts by project that we anticipate to expend in each fiscal year. Finally, current procurement policy allows contract modifications of $1 million or 10%, whichever is higher, and we want to be in compliance with want the policy to be congruent with the procurement policy. The purpose of the proposed policy is to, number one, allow the board to maintain its policy role, allow the general manager to respond to unanticipated needs and cash flow needs that are different than the anticipated budget, to expend the capital budget to deliver safety, customer, and infrastructure improvements as quickly and as efficiently as possible, and to comply with the new capital funding agreement that requires notification to the jurisdiction for reprogrammings of over $1 million. In this proposed policy, we're making an important change by redefining projects more narrowly. For example, a Metro Matters project, as defined, was rolling stock rail with several sub-projects underneath that. Under the more narrowly defined projects,
would be, an example would be CIP 057, replacement of 1,000 series rail cars within a larger category. We're also trying to ensure transparency. The proposed policy requires notification in the monthly reports of all reports of any reprogrammings. And finally, we've tried to develop a policy that's simple to follow and is transparent both to the board and to the jurisdictions. To develop this plan, we looked for best practices. One best practice is the Government Finance Officers Association. This is some of their policy guidance. There is a realization that a budget is a plan, and the plans will change, and there need to be procedures in place to deal with those circumstances, and that's why we're here today. Finally, we need to be open to the jurisdictions and to the board, reporting changes as they occur, and that's what we've tried to do in the policy. Next slide, please. So we're really looking at all of the reprogramming policies. We're here today to talk about the capital budget reprogramming policies, as well as the capital budget reimbursable projects. In the future, we're planning spring of 2011 to come forward with a revised reprogramming policy for the operating budget. We're timing that with the implementation of our new financial systems. With the implementation of the changes to the financial systems, we will be implementing commitment control. And how we implement commitment control will affect what those policies need to look like. So that's something that we plan to bring forth in the future. This shows a comparison of the existing policy and the recommended policy. As I indicated previously, projects are now defined more narrowly than before. The recommended policy would allow the general manager the authority to move up to $5 million both between projects and between categories to deal with cash flow needs, project changes, unanticipated situations. So let me give you a couple examples of when a reprogramming might be needed. Let's say we have a $10 million project that is delayed for environmental or other reasons. And it might be delayed for 10 months beyond the current fiscal year. That would give us the opportunity to pull forward another project that had been budgeted in the next fiscal year and begin work on that now. Another might be a project that's progressing more quickly than anticipated. I mentioned earlier we budget based on projected cash expenditures. If we're able to advance a project to complete it for our customers more quickly, we will need additional funds, and those could be accessed from another project that's moving more slowly. Excuse me. It's important to note that what we're talking about, that the board will maintain, it's the initiation of new projects. Under the proposed policy, the general manager does not, except in emergency situations, have the authority to initiate a new project. So we're really talking about movement between projects that have already been approved by the board and have been presented to the jurisdictions. And I think that's an important point. The definition of project I already talked about, the $5 million. Movement of funds between categories also has a slightly different definition than it did under the previous agreement. Under Metro Matters, we did not move funds between categories, but even categories was defined in a different way. The categories, there were four main categories, IRP, bus expansion. They were very, very large categories. In the current capital funding agreement, categories defined much more narrowly and includes things like vehicles and vehicle parts, rail system infrastructure, maintenance facilities, systems and technology. So there is a change in the terms that we're using, and we've tried to crosswalk them here. The addition of headcount in both instances, both previously and in the proposed policy, board approval would be required. Emergency programming, the GM had the authority to move 200,000 with board notification. The notification requirement would remain. And finally, reprogramming of less than 200,000, and that was the movement that was allowed by the general manager, was to be reported to the board. We are proposing reporting all reprogramming actions, both to the jurisdictions and the board, to be open and within the spirit of the capital funding agreement. This gives you a little perspective on how we've changed some of the definitions. Under Metro Matters in the previous capital reprogramming policy, we defined project more broadly, and these are some of the examples that I mentioned earlier. Project included rolling stock bus, rolling stock rail, and within those there were project elements. And again, the policy required board approval of reprogramming actions in excess of 200,000 between projects. The next slide shows the more narrow definition of project. Project is now defined at the next step in, and so a project, CIPO 57, 1,000 series rail cars, CIPO 60, the 4,000 series replacement. So we're defining project much more narrowly than we had before, and that's one of the reasons that we're proposing the increase. On the surface, it looks like a big increase to go from 200,000 to 5 million, but we're also making changes in the definitions to be, again, more transparent to the board and to the jurisdiction.
So the amounts that we've talked about shifting from and to really are more relevant to the detail that we find under each category, such that that movement of dollars, amounts that you're recommending, would be more appropriate than the prior approval agreement because of the...
I think so. I think it reflects the more narrow definition of project. I mean, in the previous slide, if you could go back, Metro Matters required any reprogramming action between, in this example, rolling stock bus and rolling stock rail to come to the board. But within the project, the movements could be made without notification. They could be made by the general manager. So what we're proposing is a much more transparent process, but I think one that takes into account the movement that may need to occur between projects.
Mr. Downing and Mr. Linton.
Yeah, just following up on that. One, I certainly agree there should be clear, transparent process and flexibility. Times and different times do change. I am a little concerned. Projects are not all alike. And to have a rule that says $5 million can be moved could have very strange consequences. For example, take $5 million out of a $6 million project and put it somewhere else. I would be much more comfortable if there were also some range of how much impact would occur to a project before the general manager's authority runs out and the board would have to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. The intention is not to eliminate a project that the board has approved. The intention is really just to accelerate projects if other projects are slow, as Matt indicated. So we had to put additional criteria to it.
Other reprogramming constraints that I've lived under have things like not more than 10% to come out of, mm-hmm. or not more than 10% to go into. I don't know if that's the right number, but it does address that issue.
Mr. Linton.
I appreciate the effort to in transparency and to provide more project definition. However, that still is something that is a little concern to me because, unfortunately, a categorical description of a project still provides an opportunity for elements within it substantially to be changed, and the projects still carry that project definition. And I'm thinking, quite frankly, we've had a couple of IT projects where if you looked at the categorical name of that project, that project could actually be changed substantially in terms of its substance and still carry the same categorical title, and money could in fact be moved into that area for a major change and then comes back to the board with a real surprise. And that's happened kind of recently, and it kind of concerns me. And that's the one area where I would like to see some either further information under project, something a little more concrete that gives me some comfort with that movement. So that's just a
point. Mr. Graham has a question as well.
Is it a question or comment?
Well, it's a comment at this stage because I think you can form it as
comment?
Well. We have not completed the presentation, so we're not.
I don't have a question. Should I make it now?
Sure.
Well, I'm just back from the hustings.
Oh, God.
And
we're not in that category yet.
No, but I am. And I can tell you it's all very fresh in my mind. I want to say God saved me from the metro escalators and other issues, but I've heard a great deal about Metro WMATA over the past 3 to 4 months, particularly, and it's a all of that comes to mind on this issue, because of the type of message that I come back with, which is, you know, you explain, it's somewhat complex, but in the final analysis it's pretty clear, which is the people that I represent have said to me in many different ways they want closer oversight of this management. Now, I say to them, well, but we try to pull ourselves out of micromanagement. You know, when I first came on the board, you know, we were definitely micromanagers. We had a whole range of very detailed responsibilities, sometimes very minute appointments, budget, everything else. But quite frankly, people didn't want to hear that. They said, you're a member of the Metro Board of Directors. You've been a member for 12 years. And we want you to exert greater oversight on safety issues and other issues. And so to have this be my first issue as a member of this committee to come back to extend the reprogramming to $5 million, you know, quite frankly, leaves me cold. And I don't think I can support this right now. I think I'm willing to look at these types of changes, perhaps when there's a new general manager, with all due respect to our very, very able interim general manager, and you know I mean that, but perhaps when there is a new management regime, there's a new discussion. But I think prior to that, I'm very, very reluctant to support this type of change, because I don't think I want to send a message today, for sure, with all of this very fresh in my mind, that we are going to permit greater discretion to Metro WMATA staff, when I think what the public that I have heard from is saying, we want you to provide greater oversight, closer oversight of these issues. And particularly, let me conclude by saying this, the capital budget has been a matter of great concern to me and others on this board. I haven't been the only one, but others on this board for some years. And the problems of underspending and so forth have been issues that I have raised repeatedly. So for that reason also, I'm not comfortable with the notion of greater discretion at this time. So I just wanted to, I may be in order or out of order, but I wanted to make that comment to on the larger issue that's before us today. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
If you want to respond to
this. Well, there were a couple of points I just wanted to try to address. Number one, the timeliness of this is really related to the recently adopted capital funding agreement. With the negotiations with the jurisdictions, I pledged to them that we would get a revised capital reprogramming policy to the board as quickly as possible. Like I said, the current policy is 10 years old, doesn't really reflect the current way we're defining project. And so that was one of the reasons that we brought it forth today. With regard to control, I hear the concerns from the members of the committee. Everything would still have to follow under our procurement policy. I mean, changes of 10% or $1 million would still have to be approved by the board. So this is not a way to write a blank check or anything like that. I mean, we still have those kind of procedures and policies in place. And finally, what we're really talking about is, Mr. Graham, one of the issues you talked about is underspending and being able to, within an approved project, if we're underspending, be able to take those dollars and move them to a project that might be able to be advanced. Another board-approved project in the CIP where we could move more quickly. So that's.
But this, if I may, there's no case been made that this board's action or inaction has in any way delayed reprogrammings. You know, the fact of the matter is that we have acted with expedition whenever it's been presented to us. So I don't think any suggestion can be made that we held things up in any way. And I don't think we have in the past, and I don't think we will in the future.
Can I just follow up with Mr. Brown's point? In working with the jurisdictions, where have you gotten in terms of working with the jurisdictions on this?
We did solicit comments. We did a couple things. One, we tried to look at our transit peers, and we also tried to look at the JCC members. The JCC members provided input via email. It wasn't something we were able to discuss at the regular JCC meeting, but I did have some conversations over the phone, and I got some good suggestions. And there are a couple different categories. I mean, I'll go with what we heard from the jurisdictional partners first. One indicated that he thought that it wasn't really the amount that was important, it was more the reason
why the funds were being moved. If it was a project was no longer needed and funds were being reallocated, projects over budget needs to be completed, bids come in lower that could be used on another project. So in one view, it was the dollar threshold was less important than the reason why. The reason we constructed the policy like it is was we wanted to make it less subjective. We wanted bright lines. We wanted it to be clear. We wanted people to know when they needed to move forward with a reprogramming policy. We also had comments related to the reprogramming between projects. There were some concerns that $5 million was too high. Two jurisdictions suggested between $1 million and $3 million might be more appropriate. Finally, with regard to reprogramming between categories, there's a mixed view. Some indicated that all of those actions should be brought to the board. Some thought the threshold should be lower. And one thought that that should not be permitted at all. So that it was a wide variety. We also looked at some of the peer jurisdictions. The District of Columbia, Mr. Graham, the reprogrammings are allowed up to $500,000. But it's a passive approval by the, as I understand, it's a passive approval by the council. So it can be presented, and if it's not addressed, it's deemed approved. When we get to some of the other jurisdictions, frankly, the size of the program and the definition of project becomes hard to compare our current policy to. Frankly, our policy is most in line, or the proposed policy is most in line with what we found at SEPTA in Pennsylvania. They're allowed the movement of up to $5 million between projects. They do have to provide advance notice to what's called the Advisory Committee of the Planning Commission. Anything in excess of that requires Planning Commission approval. There's some other agencies.
That gives us, I just wanted to get some feedback as to how much
sure.
the conversation has been had.
Sure.
Mr. Benjamin.
First of all, I agree very strongly with Mr. Brown's statement that we do need to change the old policy. If for no other reason than what we're dealing with now is a real live expenditure-based program. And the old policy applied to a commitment and obligation-based program. So as you go through the year, one of the things you need to do as a real-time manager, and what local jurisdictions all do, is they do, in fact, reprogram as they see that one project's moving slowly and another project is moving more quickly, and therefore you want to be able to move the money from one to the other. We do that in Maryland all the time. I think all jurisdictions do that. So I think more flexibility is clearly needed. I do get a little bit concerned when I read some of this stuff and I don't even understand it. I look at phrases in here. First of all, I believe, Matt, one of the things you said was that the percentages still stay in the policy. I don't see that in the resolution.
I'm sorry.
You didn't say that?
The procurement policy would still apply. I mean, this doesn't supersede the procurement policy.
Yeah, but what happens if you're not doing a procurement? What if the money is for something that isn't for being procured?
It could be for something that a contract that's progressing more quickly, or if there's in-house labor.
I understand. But I guess what I'm saying is I like what Mr. Downey said, which is that ought to stand alone here. And it ought to be something where very clearly the same thing applies here as might apply in the procurement policy, because sometimes you actually do things with in-house labor.
Right.
And therefore procurement wouldn't apply to it. I read things like $5 million on an annual cumulative basis between the current budget year's categories or of vehicles, parts, rail system, et cetera. What does that mean? A reprogramming action of over $5 million on an annual cumulative basis between categories or projects?
So on an annual basis, reprogramming actions of $1 million, $2 million would add up, and when we got to
what does that apply to?
To movement.
All programming actions or programming actions from a particular project or a particular category?
It applies to both between particular project and a particular category.
But so I could do $5 million out of one category and then $5 million out of another category and so on, so that every category could get $5 million taken out or put in.
Yeah.
And is it an out action or an in action when it applies? In other words, if I take from five categories and I have a grand total of $5 million and I put it into one, have I tripped it or not?
We could clarify that it was meant to be $5 million, both in and out.
Okay, I guess what he's saying is grand total for the year, 5 million in or out. I think there's wording like this that needs to be thought through carefully and make sure it's worded very clearly, because the only thing we've got is this resolution. I think the idea of the percentages that Mr. Downey talked about is a very important one and needs to be memorialized in the resolution. And finally, what I thought I heard you say was that although you had emails back and forth with the various jurisdictions and the staff, you never actually had them all in one room and had a discussion with them on this?
At the time we had the JCC meeting, the policy hadn't been fully developed, okay. And we didn't have anything to discuss.
I would suggest that this is an important enough issue that very often the interactions between those people talking together and not just noticing somebody else's email does in fact improve the quality of the product. And maybe we need to do one more cycle through the JCC.
I agree. I have to compliment the JCC. They were very helpful. They responded to each other's emails, commented on previous comments. So I think we had the best discussion we could electronically, but I hear your point about discussing in a physical
sense. I think that's important enough to take more time and do it more carefully.
Mr. McKay has asked, and I think he has a motion, and I think it will be a helpful motion.
Yeah.
This has been brought in. Stimulated the discussion that's needed, but I think in order for us to get to a final policy, come before the board.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, in light of the questions that have been raised, I move that we defer this item, that it be sent back to a real JCC meeting where there can be a thorough discussion. I think the board is due more information on Mr. Downey's comment. In addition, I have a concern about moving between categories. In my jurisdiction, we don't do that without a board vote. So I'd like a little bit more clarity on how expansive that is. And then lastly, justification for the $5 million figure. If there are examples in the past of where we would have needed that, where we could have expedited things, perhaps giving this board some examples of where this new policy would have helped in the past will help us understand what the $5 million threshold is. So with that information, I move that we defer this item.
Second.
Second.
Any questions? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
If I could, I'd like to finish one last slide, just so that the committees that were...
You're out of order.
Let me
take that apart. Thank you. I think what we want to do is look at the entire item, and I don't think that changes the reimbursable piece. I think the review will be thorough enough for us. Okay. Thank you. The next item, let me just say, the next two items should go very quickly, and I have to tell you, we have added, and I think where we added it shows exactly time-wise where it's brought us. The next item is the TIFIA loan application, and this is something that has been brought to us and is time-sensitive in terms of an application to Department of Transportation for the opportunity.
Sure. I move this item.
Let me have Ms. Carroll just give one moment of comment, okay, so that everybody understands.
I can
understands
just take
as well
a couple of sentences. I won't
That's
go through
it.
The slides. Mm-hmm. We actually, this is in, we were invited to issue a, apply or actually submit a letter of interest to the U.S. DOT there for the TIFIA program. We did that in March. We actually are looking, our intent here is to submit an application, and what's before you is the approval for us to submit an application. If we are invited by the U.S. DOT to submit it, okay. And the application is primarily to look at additional, to get actually financing for financing, economic financing for our capital program. So the intent is to use it for lines of credit replacements as well as for loans in our six-year capital program. It's a better cost of financing if we are actually approved for this. It would actually save on our capital budget a couple million dollars a year, and we're asking for permission to, if we get invited to actually submit that application.
Okay. Mr. Downey.
So we have not been invited to, my understanding is the invitations went out yesterday, so if we didn't hear from them, I suspect we'll be hearing negative, but it doesn't mean that we couldn't apply next year, so.
Okay. Is there a motion?
Not invited.
I'm just wondering, given Mr. Downey's point, whether we want to do that now or not.
I if I understand, the timing is such that
we could have today.
Had the authority from the board to move forward.
Yeah.
If not, then...
I have no problem with moving under the assumption that we actually are invited.
Yes.
Yeah. We should have it, the ability to apply.
That's
but I don't think
if
we're going to be invited to.
You're not. And any other comments?
One question. Was this a two-part process? We expressed a letter of interest, and then you wait for the invite?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the way it works.
Yeah, no, it's...
Just another comment here. We've always had the opportunity for jurisdictions to opt out of, on the line of credit piece, the debt.
On the debt piece, yes.
Debt piece. Correct. So in doing this, we still have that open to us. Yeah. Okay. All those in favor of us making the application?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Was it seconded?
Didn't hear a second. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Thank you. those opposed? Okay. That's great. And the last is a grant for transit security, and it is establishing another capital project and program so that these funds can be used.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Searles, who's making quickly?
Carol's making.
Okay.
The chief is here, certainly can go through the presentation. He actually applied his department for a grant for $18 million. We were approved. It's a 100% grant. It is not matched, which is great news. So it'll establish a new capital program. The modification that we'll make here, the MEAD says it's $18 million, which is the total amount of the grant. But actually, since we aren't an expenditure based on our budget, we're modifying this to indicate what the actual dollar amount will be for FY11. Although the total budget, back to your question, Mr. Benjamin, the total program will be $18 million, but the this year expenditure will be somewhat less than that. But we are modifying the
meeting. Are we going to see the $18 million and how it's spread over several years, or what are we approving?
We're approving the FY11 capital, the adjustment to the capital budget for FY11.
But are we also approving
and
the entire project?
And the total amount for the grant.
You're approving the total project, which is $18 million,
and the FY11 amount?
And the FY11 amount, which we do not have as of yet. So it'll have to be an amended. We'll have to provide that at a later date. I apologize.
May I suggest, then, that we send this to the board without action?
Yeah.
Second.
Good question. Thank you. I guess I'm concerned. I don't see where, what facilities are going to benefit from this. It won't change my opinion about doing it because I think it's necessary, but it would pique my interest because obviously there are some facilities I'm thinking of, in particular a bus yard in the city of Alexandria, that may not be in long-term existence. It may be moved in the future. So when we're looking at this money, is this personnel costs for increased security, or is this intricate devices that we're looking to install and build that cannot be moved to another location if we decide to vacate a property?
Correct. This does not include personnel. This includes the security hardenings at Alexandria Yard, at New Carrollton, and at Brentwood, as well as some security enhancements for some of our buses, some technologies to be used. The Washington Metro, as many transit agencies across the country, made applications in FY10 for security enhancements, and those were based on certain levels of risk, and prioritizations were made by the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, TSA, and we were fortunate to have identified these projects as being important enough that they awarded us $18.5 million. And we are very thankful to Secretary Napolitano, TSA Administrator John Pistol, and FEMA for identifying those needs and enabling us to enhance the safety and security of our employees as well as our patrons.
Okay. Could I request that the board just receive a list of those priorities so that we know what they are? I think there's a much greater need than this. This is a tremendous help, and I agree with you. It's a great application, but I would like to at least see, just from my own knowledge, what facilities and what we're doing at those, by correspondence or however you feel appropriate. There may be information in there you might not want, to share, but, you know, however you feel appropriate to communicate with the board where we're doing things and how they were prioritized would be helpful.
We'll send a report to the board.
Thank you.
Mr. Lagley.
I had actually a similar question, and I think the gentleman just requested, you know, if the expenditure is being used for a facility that we're not going to be at permanently is one issue. The other issue was we recently had an invasion in one of our bus garages, the staff had laid out a very extensive approach to trying to increase the security. Are these dollars going to be applied towards that effort? And was that some of what was submitted to Homeland Security in the process, or it just so happened that we had already submitted money and we now have identified hardenings at some of these garages that we can now apply for these dollars?
I previously submitted to this board in past years were those efforts to increase security hardenings at various bus divisions. The component of this particular award does speak to enhancing security, not on the infrastructure, but the use of technologies that we could remotely disable a bus and certain amounts of buses that it involves. Again, previous years, we've made applications to amend the budget for a variety of different security grant initiatives, and this approach would be just to do the same thing.
There's a motion on the table. It is to defer, to move it to the board without action, as well as to provide information. All those in favor?
Aye. I'll second that.
Okay. We are at the time limit for this meeting, so I'm going to ask. We made an adjustment in our agenda, and I'd like for us to reconsider some of the time elements of this. The question was asked to do the smart trip. I'm pretty much concerned about time.
Where is Mr. Zimmerman?
And Mrs. Zimmerman is out here.
Minutes on that topic.
That was the question I was going to ask you, Mrs. Zimmerman, because 15 minutes is very hard to come by here. Usually multiplies. Then let's quickly go to Ms. Kissel. The item that was the memo that was submitted to board members outlined some of the smart trip and other fair issues. Mm-hmm. And if you can go through within the 15, and you can give us 2 or 3 minutes, and then we leave the remainder for questions to resolve where we need to go. And I think this was raised because board members want to hear what are going to be our options so that as you move forward for implementation, it does not get done in a direction that we might not have had enough input. Right. So assumption that you're moving forward.
Thank you. So very quickly, when we the board had made the decision in June to reduce the price of the smart trip card to $250, we had actually come back and done an analysis, and I realized that we had an issue with our current entry and exit fare rules, if you will, and we actually understood that there might be some what we called quote-unquote gaming issues with how that we would actually experience. So what we did, and I have this chart up here, which we'll go through very quickly. We actually had provided some memos to the board communicating this a couple of times. We had presented to the Riders Advisory Council this chart that you'll see here, getting their input as to what some of the solutions are that we could actually derive. So I have Steve Holland here. He's the Director for Fair Media and Distribution. He was with me at the Writers Advisory Council, and he can take you quickly through this. The first chart I'll just take you through is this is just to remind you of our current fair media. Obviously, it's paper and smart trip cards. And the current rules for paper are you need $1.85 on your fair card to get into the system, and the cost of the trip is the exit. For the smart trip user, as you purchase your first card, your first trip, you can enter the system with a zero balance and then exit on rail and bus. The balance can go negative once. And then your second trip, you would presumably have to add value to it to go again. That's our current rules on exit and entry. And then I'll have Steve take you through some of the options that we have come up with to deal with this issue we have.
Quickly as you can, Steve.
Okay. I was going to say we have 3 pages and 7 options, so
But how much time?
Go to the pages of options.
Yeah, let's just go to the table.
Go to the pages with the options listed as a table.
Sure. Great. I'm sorry, I was just asking about how many minutes do you want to devote to? 2 minutes for seven options. Okay.
But if you can do two, I'll take two over to you.
Yeah. Okay. It's hard for me to read from my angle, so I'm sorry. I'm going to go from my paper. Okay. The first option, option A, is to reduce the card to 250. And basically to ignore the potential gaming that could go on and to take the financial risk, which we've estimated as up to potentially $1 million a month. Option B is what we call a rebate, which is that you would still pay $5 up front for the card, but after using the card twice, you would get a rebate of $250, so that the net is that you pay $250. And again, trying to address the gaming there.
And just on a point on that, our system would be able to automatically provide the rider with the rebate. They would not have to mail anything in. Our system would be able to accommodate for that. So.
Yep. And obviously, very quickly, there's pros and cons to all of these options, but we just wanted to lay them all out so that everybody could have a look. Option C would be to no longer allow customers to go negative on their card. Next page. Option D is status quo, meaning no change at all, continue to charge $5 for the card. Option E is to change the minimum entry, so similar to paper cards and rail, you would need to have you would need to have a minimum fare on your card. As you can see in rail, that would be $1.10. May sound a little bit like a strange number. Minimum fare with a smart trip card is $1.60. You could potentially have a bus transfer, so that's where we came up with the $1.10. And it would only be 45 cents if you were traveling senior disabled fare. Option F is what we call maximum negative, which, in other words, instead of saying you can't go negative at all, we would allow you to go negative, but only up to a maximum of $2.50. And then finally, option G, which was actually a recommendation from the RAC, was to simply not sell any cards that come with $0 of stored value. And so if you had some type of minimum, for instance, $2.50 potentially, that would seem to address the gaming issue. So all of these kind of attack the issues from different places, either from what you need to get in, what you need to get out, what the cost of the card is, what kind of development would be needed to be done on our side. So that's the two-minute version of the seven options.
Okay. Questions? Let me start with Mr. Lynch. He's on the committee, and then I'll come around. Yes.
I just want to make this comment to the board, and I think, you know, we recognize that we somewhere in our future, we have an open payment system on consideration. We've had a series of elements of problems over the last couple of weeks, all of which would go away with the open payment system. At some point, I think the board really needs to look at what that system is, because all of these limited intelligence on the fare gates that's created all the problems with the software changes, with the various fare rules that we wanted to do, a number of these, and this particular issue as well, would go away. So I think we need to keep that in mind as we continue to pay into continuing what we have, because the kind of flexibility that this board is wanting to have in terms of policies and customer friendliness and all of that, there are limitations in this system that will continue to create these problems.
Recognized, and now we're at immediacy. What do we do now?
I have one question. The $1 million that was projected in terms of loss, how did we come about that number? I understand the limitations of fair media, and we don't have a lot of that anymore, and concerns mm-hmm. about that not being available. But I'm very interested in the risks analysis that suggested that we would lose potentially $1 million
a month.
And the this is a methodology that we use. Matt can briefly tell you how we've come up with that number.
We don't know a lot of what the behavior of what our customers would do. We know that this would be an option. Predicting how many would go to the store and purchase a bunch of cards and run them through the system is hard to predict. So what we try to do is we broke out various fare ranges, $1.50 to $2.50, $2.50 to $3.50, $3.50 to $4.50, and $4.50 and above. We anticipated that the likelihood of someone cheating the system or taking advantage of this would increase as the fares got higher. We made some assumptions. We anticipated, for example, that 20% of those who paid fares of $4.50 or higher might take advantage of this system. We graduated that down with the various fare categories that I spoke about. So we tried to estimate what consumer behavior would be given what the various fares that they would pay.
So but you have no data. You don't have any data that on fare evasion or that, you know,
no.
These are just purely assumptions.
We don't.
And we have no knowledge of behavior of our customers.
We do not.
That will allow us to recognize the cost-benefit analysis of this and whether or not the risk that we are incurring is really equal to our exposure.
Well, let me just comment, because it's hard to assume what the behavior is going to be. And I will say that if whatever rules we may choose, any customer, if they're the right rules, the customer wouldn't be doing anything illegal. The customer would be actually doing something that we have approved. So I don't want to give the impression, and any customer would look at it and say, well, if I can spend $2.50 for a card and, you know, then just take a $5.35 trip and be able to go negative $2.50, that's a deal. I'm only, you know, I can actually buy a card and then toss it and do that. So you're right. We don't have any type of specific data. We had to use a methodology and make assumptions.
I mean, we know that if everybody took advantage, we could lose $8 million in a month. And from that number, we started analyzing the various fare components and where it would be most attractive.
Mr. Zimmerman?
Just to clarify, the table you have here, item C was the one that let's go back. Item A is what you were afraid of if you simply implemented what the board, in fact, approved in the budget.
Right.
Not having raised this issue before. And then item C is what you proposed to do and was announced that was going to be implemented.
I think in one of the earlier memos we did propose C, and then in the most recent memo.
I didn't mean memo. I meant when the agency announced it was going to be eliminating going negative, mm-hmm. which of course generated an uproar, mm-hmm. which resulted in the chairman having to intervene to tell you not to do it. But isn't C what it was?
That's correct.
Yes.
Okay. So, and then there are a number of variations here. It seems to me the focus is on two of them. One of which you seem to prefer, which I think is F, and the other, which the Riders Council, you said, recommended, which is G.
G was a recommendation that sort of came up spontaneously when we were presenting the options to them.
So I mean, it mischaracterized. It was necessarily a recommendation of the RAC, but it was a recommendation that came forward in discussion with the RAC.
It was a recommendation of one member of the RAC.
Okay.
The rest of the Riders Advisory Council were actually... We didn't have a consensus.
Okay, that's fine. I just want to understand what are the options we're really looking at here. The question that comes to my mind as I looked at them, particularly looking at, for instance, the, I guess it's the F, which would give a maximum negative of 250. Of the current usage of SmartTrip by our riders, when you look at all those instances in which somebody does go negative, mm-hmm. what does that distribution look like? How much is the typical negative fare?
Yeah, I mean, obviously with the fare increase being pretty recent, we don't have a lot of data. So in the past, the maximum that somebody could go negative is less than somebody could today.
But you could probably get a pretty good idea of what the distribution is and, you know, what the equivalent is of this versus the fares we had before.
Yeah, we can see the average negative amount. We looked at, I think it was people who went negative and hadn't done anything in either 3 or 6 months. And so we know what that amount is?
Well, actually, what I'm talking about is people, for most people, this is a convenience item. That's the point, is it allows them, you know, to manage their cash more easily. So they go negative, and then they cover it, right?
Right.
And that's all fine. If I knew, you know, again, ignoring for a moment the fact that fares changed, and you can do this proportionally, and I would think you would have extrapolated, but let's assume we were running at these fares. If I knew that, for instance, 90% of people who went negative less than 250, that might immediately tell me this would solve 90% of the problem.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I follow your question. And that's how I think the 250 was derived, is that it addresses the gaming. It doesn't completely close the loop, because you could have somebody, for instance, take a $6 airport bus, right? But what it does do is that it limits the number of gaming that could go on, and there wouldn't be many people who would get caught in this, and yet it would address the potential gaming issue. So it was kind of relatively minimum impact from a customer viewpoint, but it also met the authority's objective of limiting the gaming.
Well, I was thinking that that's what you were reaching for. It would be nice if you had some data that actually showed that. The alternative, which is to say, why not just don't sell it for the, you know, a zero balance anyway, also seems to me a somewhat obvious thing.
Right.
There's not a lot of reason to buy a smart trip card without a balance on it, but I don't know the relative merits of that.
Yeah, the only negative we came up with that, and I think it's on the chart if we would go to the next page, is that, as you know, we're in the process of piloting a test to move the weekly paper bus pass to smart trip cards. So we thought potentially you could have somebody who wants to buy a smart trip card solely for the purpose of being able to buy the 7-day bus pass. And they wouldn't necessarily want any stored value on it. They just want to buy that pass. So they might end up with having to get some stored value on their card that they would never use.
If they want to buy the pass, and the pass were properly sold through the Smart Trip card, we wouldn't have that problem either.
There's an issue currently, which is a cubic issue, not an authority issue, that the stored value cannot be used towards the purchase of a card, toward the purchase of a pass.
But if you could put the pass on the card and I buy them simultaneously, then the problem's solved. Right. I'm not talking about using stored value. I'm saying when I go to buy the pass,
right.
When I go to buy the Smart Trip card, I say I want to buy it with a pass. That's what I'm buying. It's the same card. It's just recorded on the thing, and that's what I'm paying for, and I pay the price of the pass.
Yeah, if we had cards preloaded with the 7-day pass.
Or with the coding that gave you whatever pass system we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would seem to work.
All right. Madam Chairman, I think there are several practical alternatives here that seem like they could work, that would not create havoc for our customers, and at the same time follow through on the direction the budget gave to finally lower the cost of the card, more representative of what it costs to manufacture the card. And I think that the staff should be moving to implement that as quickly as possible, since, you know, it was part of the fare package we adopted. Reducing the price of this card was part of what we had done. An alternative that the members of this board, various of us, have been asking for a long time. Had it been properly analyzed and presented, they could have anticipated these things beforehand, and we would have had this conversation last spring before the fact instead of now after the fact.
We're looking for an option that confirms our commitment to reduce it, the ability to implement it, and that does not allow us to gain or get our greatest benefit.
Does not allow a lot of lost revenue, but at the same time.
I think we have two items that are practically there. But that is the objective. Good option if you'd like to make a motion on the table.
I'm not ready to make a motion. I'd rather explore a couple other items real quickly and make sure that we understand what we're doing here. And also, we have put some arbitrary constraints on this process that I think don't need to be there. If I go back to C, I'm sorry, go to B, right? That gives a rebate. According to this, it has no financial impact. Nothing changes except that you have to wait for two trips until you've gotten your price down to 250. Why would we not do that? What's the downside?
Cheat on trip three.
That's what I figured. But I wanted to hear where they were.
Well, we have to implement the software to do it, and we're relying on Cubic to indicate that is a feasible option, which they've indicated it is. So it's just another software application we have to put on our system.
Then let me ask Mr. Downey's question: is why would this prevent you from just doing two trips and then doing the gaming on trip three?
You could. We just felt that if you wanted to do that, I mean, to really take advantage of this, you would have to do it. Well, the maximum you could do is assuming you take two trips a day, right, every day, and then over some period of time, it becomes worthwhile. But at some point with this rule, it gets pretty complicated, and you couldn't have sort of that constant turnover and, you know, sort of one card, one ride, and I throw it away. So there's still some opportunity there. I think at one point we had terminology that said approaching zero or something like that. So yeah, there is some exposure. I think to address your original question about, you know, why wouldn't we do it, I agree that this is a very good solution. I think for me, the only potential catch on this one is that just from a customer viewpoint, they do have to put $5 out up front. And so if there's a concern that maybe the customer action would be, you know, hey, I thought I could get it for $2.50. I think all of us as rational human beings look at this and say, in the end, you did only pay $2.50 once you get the rebate. But sort of more the optics of it from a customer viewpoint.
Let me explore this just a little bit more, if I may.
What's the 15, but you can keep exploring.
Well, what I'm looking at in this whole thing is the thing that made it most difficult for me was that we were going to send people who didn't have the right value, and almost all of these end up doing that in one form or another, except for things like B, to an exit fare machine where you need to have exact change in order to get out. And almost everybody's going to say, I got my Smart Trip card so that I didn't have to deal with this. And in fact, what we're going to end up doing is letting a whole bunch of people out because they're going to say, I don't have the right change, in which case we're into the same problem we had since the beginning. So it doesn't strike me that any of these that say we're not going to let them out really works, because it just trips the same mechanism of we are inconveniencing our riders by making them go to a machine that doesn't accept anything other than exact change.
The beauty of this solution is that it doesn't require any changes to the entry rules, the exit rules, or to the
right.
The
it's great for us. It's
fares.
Great for us, but it's not good for the passenger. And I care about the passenger in this discussion. I really do. And so I tend to go to those that say customer impacts and say you got to go to the exit fare machine and say that one doesn't work. Well, now let me just pursue this for a moment, if I may, Madam Chair. When we made our decision to go to the $2.50, it was based upon a staff statement, admittedly at a point where staff had no chance to really check into it, that in fact the cards cost us about $2.50. I understand now, first of all, that we have a limited number of cards, that those cards are going to run out and the current manufacturer will not make any more. I understand also that they cost something closer to $3.40. Not $2.50?
I think it's $3.40. That's correct.
Okay. So we were making decisions with inadequate and incorrect information. And this whole thing is now charging down a line based upon an original decision that was not well informed. The question I have is there a combination, and I think I can think of a couple, of cost of card, which may be higher than $2.50 but lower than $5, minimum entry fare that will in fact allow us to make all of this work very smoothly without having to send anybody to an exit fare machine and allowing some amount of negative because they bought for a little bit more than $2.50. And I think an analysis of that might find something that works very smoothly, and yeah, we won't be able to get down to our $2.50, but it'll be $3 or $3.25. Or whatever it is. And I don't see that here because we're constrained by that $2.50, and we're relying too heavily on the exit fare, which I think is the big thing we don't want to do.
Could you move the chart up again to the next last two options?
Yeah.
Well, it's not an action item anyway. It's not an action item. We're trying to get the staff to work through this.
It is not an action item, or it is an action item.
It was added to action.
What?
It was added to action.
As an action item?
Well, if we can find an action.
Well,
you don't have to take an action.
We don't have to take an
action. It's not on the agenda at all. It's not on the agenda.
No, it was added.
It was not an agenda item because we really are lacking information. Adequate direction, and I'm not sure we're getting all of it today. But the last two, and if we wanted to set the criteria, we did start with a change that was made. We gave the customers that view. We've given them lots of challenges in the changes that we've made up to now. And if we can find a way that I think keeps that commitment to them, and at least not impact them on the exit changing the fare piece on the outside, is probably the direction that we want to go. Because
were you saying what I was saying? I'm not quite sure.
I think it basically is.
Okay.
I think we started. We're correcting where we started with the change, and I think that in the last one. F, we get, I think it was F though. That was the one that I.
There's a G.
At.
There's a G.
There's a G.
Yeah.
Well, that's here.
Yeah. That's the minimum, no charge, no charge. I'm sorry, I have to pull my memo. I can't read that.
Yeah.
But I think it was F that was shared with us in the memo, not G. We got to F, right? Was there a G in the memo?
Yeah, there's a, this is F, and then there's the
okay.
G that. The G is the one that recommendation we received from the Riders Advisory Council. This one.
Okay. So the direction, I just think the direction should try and keep us in the direction of where we've started, finding the most minimal impact on the customer rather than where you're saying that we may have been given poor information about the cost of the card, but we really have. Either we have to go back and tell the customer, no, we're not charging, and we've already implemented a fare piece. I think we should be correcting it based upon where we implement it, and that is starting with the 250 card and making the corrections on how best to not do the gaming card, not to...
See, that I believe that 250, which was an uninformed decision by the board or a decision based upon inappropriate information, is one of the things that's causing a lot of this problem. And I think a combination of a cost of card which is less than $5, which was our objective, and 250 was just an arbitrary number we came up with because of information that staff gave when they didn't really have the correct information available to them, and I don't blame them for that. An entry rule, which is minimum fare, and an exit rule, which reflects the proper numbers, and no use of the exit fare machines, there is such a combination, and staff can go through that, find it, and bring it back to us.
Yeah, I think we need to go back to the basic of what is the cost of card, and start from there. So, you know, we've already put information out to the general public that it's, you know, we now have a challenge, which we're going to pull that back. The other thing that the item that Mr. Benjamin made reference to talked about a software change. And every time we've had a software change, we've had major problems. And I think the board needs to acknowledge and understand that every time we've asked for a software change, we've had major problems. That's not it's something that we just assume is easy to do and is uneventful in and of itself. And it may dismiss all the other advantages that we have there because it may create other problems for our customers. So I think we need to make sure this is well-baked before we proceed, and we need to take a little more time and get a little more information back as we proceed the next time down this road. That's the only thing that I would suggest.
Mr. Graham and Mr. Downey.
Hey, Madam Chair, one other question. I note elsewhere in the material that we have sold 5,000 cards to the University of Maryland, which they are now going to turn over free to their students. They are 250 cards if you look at Maryland's cost, and zero if you look at the students' cost. Will we be able to monitor how that test group of 5,000 people uses the card?
Yes.
A group whom I think might well be among those who look for the opportunity.
Okay.
In that particular instance, they only get one car from university. They're not allowed to have a second.
Mr. Graham.
I think we're in a pickle here.
Yes, we are.
And I don't think continuing this discussion today in this fashion is helping us.
It's not.
I don't think this is helping us. I think we should move off this agenda item and dedicate ourselves to returning for a full discussion of this, ASAP, if you will. But I think continuing this, I mean, this is a... I do have just one... This is embarrassing, is what I want to say. But let me just say that ask one other question, because I heard you say something, or somebody said this. Maybe it was you, Mr. Benjamin, that the company we've been dealing with are no longer going to be producing or these cars. Did I hear that?
That's correct, but we have secured inventory enough to get us through the next 2 years, and we have plans in place to which we will be presenting to the TRC, I believe, this month, recommendation on how to proceed going forward. So we're working
on that. So we have enough stock on hand or available that we can go for 2 years?
Yes,
so
we've already contracted.
So we don't have to go to a new company and find still another price right away?
Well, no. The reason why we're going to another technology and is because these chips are not available any longer. And a year or so ago, we actually purchased all of the chips that are used to put in these smart chip cards. So we do have sufficient inventory, but only to last for another 2 years.
Mr. Graham, if I may clarify for you, what I was saying, and to clarify again the Chief Financial Officer's statement, first of all, this is the only company that makes these cards. So once we run out of this supply, which they will no longer make, this chip and this card will no longer be available. We will have to shift to a different card with a different chip, which is, again, going back to what Mr. Linton said, you know, the open bank card is, in fact, one of the obvious solutions for that. But what's more important is that two-year supply isn't a two-year supply. If you do option A...
2 weeks.
That's a real key in this whole thing. You got to watch what you do or you don't end up with any cards.
Mr. Graham, I want you to know that this item was not part of this agenda. You were right. It was not part of this agenda because of a lot of the uncertainties. And I think the memo that went out was seeking information so that it could come to us. But it was insistent that this come on. It was an action of this committee that said they wanted to have a discussion. It was not on because it could consume a finance committee in total. So I think we must either decide that we're forwarding a criteria that we want the staff to limit its exploration to, or we need to simply abandon it and start from scratch again with a discussion that's had. But I think some direction needs to be given, as which the memo implied, by offering us the options and the information. Mr. Downey, finish your comment.
No,
there's something
because
else.
I was deferred to this one and that one.
Okay.
I want to defer this because I don't think we're getting anywhere here right now. With every passing minute, it looks worse to me. And I just can't reach it. So I'm going to move that this matter be deferred.
Second. Madam Chair.
Yeah. Mr.
Downey,
is there a question?
I think deferring it. Excellent idea, but I think we ought to ask the staff to come back with a new proposal, unconstrained by any of the factors that are currently in place, that gets the optimum solution to the problem.
All right.
Madam Chairman,
yes.
I understood this to be added as a discussion item for precisely the reason that was just described. There was no action to be taken. Staff wasn't coming to the committee to ask them to do something. Members wanted to discuss because it's the first time we've met. And it's been, you know, a big issue in the public, and people needed to, you know, and we needed to hear what the heck was going on. I think we accomplished that, and I agree there's nothing to be done here. I don't think there's anything to defer. This was to set up the larger discussion, which I think you have now done, and we're 33 minutes into the 15 minutes.
Yeah, every bit of the 15 that you're asked for. Is there a desire to simply leave this as discussion? And sure. Staff has heard the discussion.
Sure.
Staff needs no action from us other than to come back to the committee at the next appropriate time when you have provided adequate options, as Mr. Downey very well described, with as much lack of constraint to do. And I think what we need to keep focus is where we started on this. Mm-hmm. And we did start with trying to reduce the card. If that isn't going to be the option that we want to go to, what are the other things that we can do in trying to save the customer in this? Because otherwise, we've taken them through a ringer on this.
All right.
Okay. All right. That's the direction that the
you have a motion on the floor.
I'm going to ask if we could suspend the motion because there's no action.
I don't believe there was a second to the motion. So
there was.
Did you second?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
There's no action.
There are two items left here. I really do think the last item that was asked to go on the agenda is also going to provide a great deal of discussion, but I'm not sure that it is going to impact anything within the 30 days when we come back for finance committee.
But we agreed to move that to October. Is that okay?
You can say that as one statement of that discussion, Mr. Benjamin, that we come back in October to look at the use of the reimbursement funds from the SNO to the capital budget or some other option by the board. And that was due for the next meeting as well.
That's fine.
Okay. I think we will have to leave for discussion the financial report as well as the finance committee planning to our October meeting. Okay.
Madam Chair, just one bit of good news. The end of the.
It's good to have that.
Yes. As we had forecasted, a very dire end of the year of a $25 million deficit. Just to let you know, we have come in at a $16.4 million deficit. So we were able to contain. That is good news. It is good news. You're welcome. And we actually were able to contain that. So we're looking forward to this year trying to mitigate that because, as you know, that will impact the FY12 budget.
That's
good. And
there are no other items coming before the committee. We are adjourned.